Topic number two. On Tuesday evening, April 28, millions of Americans tuned in their TV sets to watch the entity President Reagan address Congress. The speech was to build support for the administration's budget, but most people were interested for a different reason. It was the first speech by the President since the assassination attempt nearly a month earlier. Many people were too absorbed in the dramatic reappearance of a wounded president to pay much attention to anything else. No one cared very much that the space shuttle Columbia supposedly arrived back in Florida that day, nor did many people give a second thought to the fact that it was a full week overdue. After all, as far as the public was concerned, the Columbia was a great success. We had seen it for ourselves on television. Based on one space shuttle flight, we are being told on all sides that we are once again on top in space. We are told that now we are 5-10 years ahead of those poor dumb Russians. It would be nice if all those things were true, but unfortunately they are not true. In AUDIO LETTER 62, I was able to make public ahead of time the real mission of the Columbia, which was military. I described the plan for us to see the Columbia lift off from Florida, but to see a different shuttle, the Enterprise, land 2 days later in California. Meanwhile, the Columbia was to have carried out a secret military mission unseen by you. The deception built into the original flight plan was bad enough. But as it turned out, the flight of the Columbia ended very quickly, in disaster, and you and I were supposed to believe otherwise. The secret disaster of the Space Shuttle Columbia and the television hoax, which we were shown to hide it, were events of great importance. That is why I have devoted my entire AUDIO LETTER 64 to giving you the details. The Space Shuttle Columbia is no more. The shuttle which we saw landing at Edwards Air Force Base in California was the training shuttle Enterprise. It had simply been relabeled with the name Columbia on its side. When the shuttle landed in California on April 14, we were initially told that it would be flown to Florida just a few days later. But as the days went by, the shuttle just stayed there. NASA cooked up one excuse after another to explain away the delays to the public. Meanwhile, frantic meetings were going on involving key joint military and NASA personnel. Things had not gone according to plan, and they were not sure what to do. One faction insisted that NASA should go ahead according to the original plan. That plan called for a switch in shuttles between California and Florida. On day one, a modified 747 would take off from Edwards Air Force Base, California, with the shuttle Enterprise riding piggyback. News cameras would be on hand to record the takeoff. The Enterprise would then be flown to its home base at White Sands, New Mexico. Meanwhile, the public would be told that the 747 with the shuttle had made an overnight stopover. Then on day two, another modified 747 carrying a different shuttle would take off from White Sands and fly to Florida. Once again, reporters would be on hand to watch the landing at Cape Canaveral. The new shuttle, of course, would have the name Columbia on the side, just as the Enterprise does. In that way, the training shuttle Enterprise was to be returned to home base and a fresh orbital rated shuttle sent to Florida. The switch would be made without the public suspecting a thing. In meetings behind closed doors about the situation, others protested that it would be foolish to go ahead as originally planned without more information. It was obvious that somehow the Russians had destroyed the Columbia, but the question was, how? The military shuttle planning group agreed that they needed the answer to that question. Otherwise, there would be no way to devise countermeasures to give the next shuttle flight a better chance. Finally, it was agreed all around that the first urgent need was to buy time. So NASA spokesmen were told to give the press a series of stalling stories about the post-flight shuttle procedures in California. Meanwhile, every available avenue of intelligence worldwide was pressed to come up with an answer to that crucial question. What happened to the Space Shuttle Columbia? Day by day, we saw brief news reports about the post-flight checkout of the Space Shuttle at Edwards Air Force Base. The shuttle was lifted onto the back of the 747, but the takeoff kept being pushed back one day after another. The Military Shuttle Planning Group was drawing a blank from their intelligence sweep about the Columbia. The shuttle stayed on the ground in California a week longer than originally planned, and still no answer came about the Columbia. NASA ran out of excuses for further stalling without raising unwelcome questions. The secret shuttle planning team was still in no position to prepare for a second orbital mission, and yet appearances have to be maintained. The United States government is crowing loudly about the supposed stunning success of the shuttle because it is the only hope left for America in space. The Space Shuttle is the only program, other than defense, which has been given increased funding by the so-called Reagan administration. Before the Shuttle Enterprise left California aboard its 747, the Shuttle Planning Group had to make a decision. Should they or should they not make the planned switch between shuttles at White Sands? There are three more orbital-rated shuttles at White Sands, and a specific mission has been planned for each one. One of the planners summed up the dilemma in the words, and I quote, "How can we send an orbital bird to the Cape? STS-2, 3, and 4 may require major modifications in order to get past the Russians. We won't know what those modifications are until we get the missing feedback on STS-1. I say send the Enterprise. We can keep it suborbital by faking an abort. Shut down one engine before press to MECO and let Enterprise return to Kennedy. That will keep Enterprise out of danger from Ivan. It will also keep the ball rolling while giving us more time to set up a successful orbital shot." Unquote. Someone else asked, "What about the public relations impact? One thing we don't need is to abort a mission this early in the program." The reply was, "Would you rather lose another orbital bird to Ivan? Besides, if we do it right, we could end up with even more public support. You know what I mean, the idea that the shuttle is safe even if something does go wrong," and so on. There was a long silence, followed by more discussion, but finally the suggestion was adopted. On Monday, April 27th, the 747 bearing the Shuttle Enterprise took off from Edwards Air Force Base, California. The following day, we saw the same shuttle, the Training Shuttle Enterprise, landing in Florida. There was no switch. The secret shuttle planners are still feeling their way. The plan could be changed, but as of now, it will be the Training Shuttle Enterprise that rolls out to the launch pad at Cape Canaveral later this summer. It will look just like the Columbia did before its April launch, mated to a giant fuel tank and huge solid rocket boosters. NASA is presently shooting for the very early launch date of September 30, 1981. According to the present plan, the launch is to proceed smoothly for the first few minutes. Unlike the Columbia, the Enterprise will not veer north toward the kind of orbit forbidden by Russia. Then one engine will shut down prematurely. It will be earlier in the flight than the point at which contact with Columbia was lost last April. Then, as we are still watching on television, the Enterprise will return for its alleged emergency landing at Kennedy. By now, the Enterprise has made so many computerized landings that NASA has confidence that the landing will be made safely. There will be an uproar about the aborted space flight, but it will not last long. Aided by the controlled major media, NASA will convince most Americans that the safe outcome of the supposed emergency is what counts. It will be said that this just proves how reliable the shuttle really is. By staging an aborted shuttle mission this fall of 1981, the joint military and NASA shuttle team will be buying time. They will not be expected to launch another mission until early 1982. By then, they are hoping to have learned what they must do to get past the Russians into space. Topic number 3. When news of the presidential assassination attempt here in Washington flashed around the world last March 30, it triggered an old concern in many minds. America was caught in a vulnerable moment. Would some other country try to take advantage in some way? Most of all, would Russia decide to invade Poland? At that time, headlines were telling us that an invasion might be imminent. As it turned out then, our worries were unfounded. Russia had made no move toward Poland. Instead, they were in the process of cooling down the latest Solidarity labor crisis. Likewise, other nations around the world generally acted with restraint following news of the shooting. That is, all the world's nations except one. The lone exception was Israel. The timing could not have been more precise, my friends, if it had been planned in advance. As the first shocking bulletins of the shooting flashed across America, Israeli warplanes were starting their engines. As White House spokesmen were gathering to brief the press, Israeli fighter bombers were gathering over at Lebanon. Through the afternoon and evening, we Americans huddled around our television sets for the latest word from George Washington University Hospital. Meanwhile, Lebanese villagers were huddling in basements and bombed out shelters as Israeli missiles and bombs exploded all around them. On the BBC World Service and other shortwave radio news reports around the world, the sudden new Israeli raids on Lebanon that day were big news. Not so here in America. News of the presidential shooting and its aftermath drowned out everything else. It was not until Syrian troops began making moves in response to the Israeli raids that Lebanon began to enter our consciousness here. Day by day, the Israelis and Syrians lashed out at one another more and more, directly and through surrogates in Lebanon. On April 28, Israeli jets shot down two Syrian helicopters over Lebanon. It was big news overseas. Here in the United States, though, it was overshadowed by the presidential speech to Congress that evening. It was not until the following day, April 29, that the Lebanon crisis received top billing in America's controlled major media. The Syrians had moved Russian SAM-6 anti-aircraft missiles into the Bekaa Valley of Lebanon. This was Syria's answer to Israel's downing of two of her helicopters the day before over Zahli. Thus, the Middle East missile crisis was born. Another mounting crisis is the growing feud between the United States and Japan. Lately, it seems as if Washington can't do anything right towards the Japanese. On the morning of April 10, 1981, the first attempt to launch the Space Shuttle Columbia took place at Cape Canaveral. It ended in failure due to a computer problem, but it was the top story that day here in America. It all but drowned out the news story that was number one that day in Japan. The previous day, an American submarine had sunk a small Japanese freighter, supposedly by ramming it. Then the submarine had left the scene without making any attempt to rescue survivors. Worse yet, the United States had not even admitted the incident to Japanese authorities until 36 hours later. In the weeks that have passed since the incident took place, the episode has raised more and more questions in Japanese minds. The United States Navy issued a report about it which differs drastically from the testimony of the 13 Japanese survivors. The Navy report even puts the location of the collision 3.5 miles away from where it actually happened. The Japanese want to know why. To this and many other puzzling questions about the incident, the Japanese are demanding answers, but they are not getting those answers. The supposedly accidental sinking of the Japanese freighter was only the opening gun in the Washington-Tokyo feud. Since then, Japan has been rocked by one shock after another at the hands of the United States. American naval vessels have sailed through Japanese fishing fleets, cutting fishing nets to ribbons. Suddenly there are revelations that American ships with nuclear weapons aboard have been using Japanese ports regularly, in secret. Secretary of State Haig canceled a visit to Japan. Even the visit of Prime Minister Suzuki to Washington recently backfired on him. He agreed to language in a joint communique that led to accusations in Japan that Suzuki was making a secret military alliance with the United States. The irony of it all is that Suzuki's troubles are due to the fact that he is resisting any such military alliance. The Bolsheviks here in America want Japan to rearm, to become the policeman of the Western Pacific. Suzuki's predecessor, Prime Minister O'Hara, was ready to go along with America's Bolsheviks despite stern warnings from Russia not to. Then O'Hara died suddenly a year ago, and Suzuki replaced him. Suzuki does not want to rearm Japan, and so America's Bolsheviks want him out of office. Japan has endured all kinds of shocks in recent months, but they all have one common denominator. They all have involved loss of face for Japan as a whole, and especially for Prime Minister Suzuki. In Asia, loss of face is a very serious matter. By using it as a political weapon, America's Bolsheviks believe they can bring down the Suzuki government. Whoever follows Suzuki will have to talk peace for domestic consumption, but he will have to prepare for war if he is to get along with Washington. Elsewhere in Asia, Red China and Vietnam have supposedly recently engaged in very heavy border fighting with many casualties. Meanwhile, the so-called Reagan administration is preparing to declare openly that it will sell America's most sophisticated weapons to Red China. The United States government, my friends, has gone insane from the cancer of Bolshevism and is leading America from folly to greater folly. In Europe, too, there is turmoil at the hands of Bolshevik agents. The government of Italy has just been brought down in a tremendous scandal involving a massive conspiracy of many of the country's leading citizens. In West Germany, Chancellor Helmut Schmidt is under fire from forces who want to undo the balance he has struck between East and West. And in France, the Bolsheviks won a tremendous victory in the election last month. Until now, France has enjoyed a special relationship with Russia, as well as with the West. The relationship has been one of trust, built up laboriously beginning with the late President Charles de Gaulle. But the new French President, Mitterrand, is working as fast as possible to change that. Mitterrand will try to bring France into the anti-Russian camp headed by the Bolsheviks here in America. My friends, crises large and small are multiplying all around us, and by and large they are not accidental. They are part of the deliberate war build-up strategy of the Bolsheviks here, which I made public in AUDIO LETTER 63. By turning the world into a cauldron of crises, they are setting the stage for Nuclear War I. The whole world is becoming like the uneasy Balkans just before World War I. World War I was set off seemingly by accident, by the assassination of Archduke Ferdinand of Austria by a terrorist. Today, we are once again in the era of terrorism, assassination, and turmoil. Like World War I, Nuclear War I will erupt suddenly from an unexpected spark, seemingly by accident. But World War I was brought about deliberately, my friends, and the same will be true of Nuclear War I. All of this is not lost on the new rulers of Russia. Russia's rulers are convinced that it is only a matter of time until all-out war breaks out between the United States and Russia. So the Russians are continuing to whittle away at America's ability to damage Russia. When the Space Shuttle Columbia took off on its ill-fated flight last April 12, a fleet of special airplanes were aloft to help track it. The United States was dependent heavily on its fleet of advanced range instrumentation aircraft. These are flying radar and communication stations known as Droop Snoots for their huge bulbous nose. This special airplane is a modified military Boeing 707, designated EC-135N. When they are not involved in space shots, the EC-135Ns also have many other uses, including the tracking of Russian satellites. There are only a few EC-135Ns, so they are all important. When the Space Shuttle Columbia took off last April, there were only 8 of them. The Space Shuttle program is an indispensable key to the current war plans of the Bolsheviks here, and the EC-135Ns are crucial to the shuttle program. On May 6, 1981, an EC-135N, nicknamed the Boss Hog, took off from its base at Wright-Patterson Air Force Base, Ohio. It headed east on what was to be a routine training flight. As the modified 707 flew eastward, it was heading for an unexpected rendezvous. Hovering high over the rolling hills of western Maryland, a lone Cosmosphere was waiting for the Boss Hog. At 10:51 a.m. Eastern Time, the pilot of the jet radioed the words Flight Level 290 to flight controllers on the ground. The plane was at 29,000 feet. Moments later, the Cosmosphere fired its charged particle beam weapon downward at the jet plane, passing miles below it. The beam blasted a hole through the top of the fuselage and another out through the bottom. Explosive decompression emptied the cabin of its air. The blast also set off a secondary explosion of some kind, turning the jet into a ball of flames. At the same time, control cables to the tail were destroyed, and the jet turned violently nose down. Instead of gliding to a crash many miles away, the ruined airplane dropped like a rock, almost straight down. Radar traffic controllers were startled to see the plane disappear suddenly from their screens. It was all over before they even knew anything had happened. On the ground, eyewitnesses heard a boom, 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 and moments later, a giant ball of fire came screaming downward out of the clouds. For 10 more minutes, small pieces of debris from the plane kept settling earthward for miles around. In any air disaster as violent as this one, the investigation usually extends over a period of months, but not this time, my friends. On Friday, May 29, just over 3 weeks after the crash, the Air Force quietly announced that its investigation was already over. They knew what had blown their radar plane out of the air. But they also declared that for the time being, the results will not be made public. While the Air Force was still reeling from the crash of the EC-135N, it became the Navy's turn. Once again, Russia's target was a highly sophisticated electronic warfare jet. The plane involved was an EA-6B Prowler, based on the nuclear supercarrier USS Nimitz. On the night of Tuesday, May 26, the Nimitz was engaged in night landing exercises just off the East Coast. Carrier landings are always dangerous, and night landings especially so. But the EA-6B has a special advantage. It is equipped with an automatic carrier landing system to permit safe landings even in conditions of zero visibility. Partly as a result, the Prowlers are known as some of the safest of all carrier aircraft. But on that night of May 26, one of Russia's new jumbo Cosmospheres was hovering high above the Nimitz. It was one of the two which I described in AUDIO LETTER 64, armed with a neutron particle beam. As an EA-6B approached the Nimitz to land, the Cosmosphere waited. At a critical moment of the final approach, the Cosmosphere fired. The invisible neutron beam instantly killed the crew of three and temporarily deranged the airplane's electronic systems. Beaten suddenly without guidance, the jet veered to the right and crashed into a deck full of airplanes. The toll? 14 dead, 48 injured, and 20 aircraft destroyed or damaged. It was the Navy's worst flight deck disaster since 1953. Day by day, my friends, the stakes are steadily increasing. The closer we get to all-out war, the more incidents like this we will see. Yet somehow we seem oblivious to the real cause. Our leaders are telling us that we have to act tough to keep the peace. Meanwhile, our supposedly tough actions are leading to the exact opposite of peace, nuclear war one. Now it's time for my last minute summary. My friends, these days we hear constantly about something called national security. What does that mean to you? Can there be any such thing as national security without national survival? If not, then our national security hangs by a thread, because our national survival is in dire jeopardy. Our leaders keep telling us that the threat to our security is Russia. Then, while we are not looking, they turn right around and taunt the Russian bear. I have a last-minute report to pass on to you in this very vein. As you know, the supercarrier Nimitz entered port only very briefly after the fiery crash of the EA-6B. It entered port on May 28 and left again just 2 days later, May 30. The official story was that it was heading for the Caribbean for continued exercises. I must now report to you that the Nimitz was ordered to the north, not to the south. In a drastic departure from normal procedure, an American carrier group has been ordered into the Norwegian and Barents Seas, right on the doorstep of Russia. This deployment is expected to be brief, but it is very dangerous. It is an insane act of bravado by the Bolsheviks here, like walking up to a bully and knocking the chip off his shoulder. Probably the Nimitz will get away with it this time. But one of these days we will cross that invisible line in the dust and the world will be at war. My friends, what is called national security today is a lie. The more we spend on national security, the less secure we become. True security can be built only on the foundation of mutual trust and mutual respect. And those things in turn can be built only on the truth. Those who secretly control America's destiny today cannot stand the truth. They are the enemies of our Lord Jesus Christ, and as He said long ago, they were liars from the beginning. We must seek the truth, cherish the truth, and pass on the truth to others. Only in that way can we break free of the satanic power that now grips America. Until next month, God willing, this is Dr. Beter. Thank you, and may God bless each and every one of you.